All right, let's get it going.
What up, people?
How y'all doing?
Hi.
I'm Sarah.
I'm Alicia.
And this is Sinister States.
So?
We're coming in to the end of our long day.
Woo woo! Listen, we just got to toss this out here. We have recorded 11 episodes at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Plus an interview, a 40-minute interview with Miss Nikki. So we know this is going to be way after you've heard Nikki's mom's story. So we're just shouting out, like, letting you know, like, this is our day. This is how our day has progressed.
It is almost 6:30.
Right.
We've been at it for 9 hours, I think.
Yeah, since 9 o'clock. I got here at, like, 8:45 this morning.
Yep. We fed Zorro.
Yeah.
Took him outside. And then we started around, like, 9:15, 9:30.
We have not stopped.
Mm-mm.
So, and then we're actually going to probably meet here in the next couple days to record some Patreon episodes online.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're not done, guys.
No, this is just one day.
This is just one day. We do this once a month, just so you guys know. Like, this is...
And you probably won't hear this episode till like mid-February.
Yeah.
So, it's January 6th.
By the time you hear this episode, we'll already have 4 more recorded at least.
Mm-hmm.
Like, 4 more for each of us. We'll already have 8 more recorded. Plus, that's not including Patreon and all the things either.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, here we go. We're back in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
So, our missing person this week is Ricky Lane Thomas Jr., he's been missing since November 6th, 1997, from Bristow, Indiana. He's a white male. Date of birth is December 21st, 1983, so he's currently 39 years old. But at the age that he disappeared, he was 13.
Wouldn't he be 40?
Well, yeah. Well, he's 40 now. Because when I pulled this, it was...
When was his birthday? Oh, December?
Yeah.
Yeah. You pulled it before December.
So I pulled it before December, so... He's 40 now.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time of his disappearance, he was 5'8", 5'9", roughly weighed 170 pounds. He was last seen in long denim shorts, a black hooded sweatshirt with Route 66 imprinted on the front. He's a Caucasian male with sandy blonde to brown hair with green hazel eyes. And he has small scars on both of his cheeks. So, the details of his disappearance, Ricky's stepfather, John Martin, saw him at the family residence in Bristow, Indiana, at approximately 11:30 a.m. I'm not making fun of it. I can't talk today. This has been an ongoing all-day thing. So, he was last seen by stepfather, John Martin. He saw him at the family's residence in Bristow, Indiana at approximately 11:30 a.m. on November 6th, 1997. Ricky called his cousin, there's the word, Daisy Applegate, between 1 and 2 p.m. and told her he planned to walk to her home, which was about 1 mile to 1.5 miles from his house. He intended to stay overnight at her home, and he was last seen walking along Oak Ridge Road in Bristow shortly after speaking on the phone with her. He never arrived at his cousin's residence and has not been seen since. Ricky and Applegate were supposed to go to Tell City, Indiana together the day that he disappeared. His call to her was to confirm their plans. He told her that he had $20 and wanted to visit McDonald's restaurant in Tell City. We just talked about McDonald's like 5 seconds ago.
Mm-hmm.
Applegate called Ricky's home later that evening to tell his mother, Tina Martin, and his stepfather that he never arrived, but Tina did not notify the police until the next day. Ricky had taken 2 backpacks and his wallet with him before leaving his home. All of his other personal belongings remained in his room. The money he told Applegate he had was left in his wallet on his dresser. His 2 13-week old puppies were missing, however. His loved ones said it's unlikely that he would have taken the puppies with him to his cousin's home. Tina and John told authorities that they did not believe Ricky ran away from the residence. He had serious behavior problems and disciplinary problems at school prior to his disappearance and had recently been expelled for threatening his teachers. His parents were supposed to be homeschooling him, but both of them were at work at the time of his disappearance. Tina and John both took polygraph tests in connection with Ricky's case, but the results have not been released. There have been no arrests in Ricky's case, and his stepfather has been named as a possible suspect in his disappearance. Ricky frequently lived with Applegate for months at a time when John and Tina said they could not control him. After Ricky vanished, an anonymous caller told Tina Martin to go to a remote location where she would find proof that he was still alive. Tina went to the direct spot and found Ricky's snow globe. John later admitted to planting the globe there, disguising his voice and making the call to Tina.
Isn't that his stepfather?
Mm-hmm. John did not participate in the search for Ricky. He and Tina are now divorced. Applegate stated she believed Ricky left on his own accord and would return home when he was grown, but police believe he met foul play. Ricky's father, Ricky Lane Sr., died in Evansville, Indiana in August of 2000. Foul play is not suspected in Ricky Sr.'s death, and it is not believed to be connected to his son's disappearance. He was not named a suspect in his son's case either. Ricky's case still remains unsolved at this time. So,
Ricky, if you're out there,
if you're there, Ricky Ricardo, if you're out there, call your mama. if you know anything about Ricky's disappearance in all seriousness, you know, reach
say
out.
Something.
Say, yeah. See something, say something. Like, that's my motto. So, if you know anything about it, please give his family the closure that they deserve, or at least his mom, because obviously his dad's already gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, that is our missing person. So, we're going to get into the Indiana case.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a little different how I'm going into this, because I'm going to tell you all of the key people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will go from there, because there's quite a few people involved.
Okay.
Like I said, it's, I think, 4 people, 1 girl. So, Shanda, this is the murder of Shanda Scherer. So, Shanda Scherer came into the world on June 6, 1979, at Pineville Community Hospital in Pineville, Kentucky. Her parents, Stephen Scherer and Jacqueline Vault, formerly known as Jacqueline Scherer, welcomed her with love and joy. As life unfolded, Shanda's parents went through a divorce, leading her mother to remarry and the family to relocate to Louisville. During her time in Louisville, Shanda attended St. Paul School, where she actively participated in various sports teams, such as cheerleading, volleyball, and softball, during her 5th and 6th grade year. However, life took another turn when Shanda's mother went through yet another divorce. And in June 1991, the family moved to New Albany, Indiana. Seeking
Did
a
you
fresh
just
start.
Say Albany?
Yeah, Albany.
Albany?
Albany.
That's how we say it in New York.
A-L-B-A-N-Y. Albany. Mm-hmm. Albany. New Albany. Whatever.
There's Albany, Georgia, too.
Indiana. Seeking a fresh start.
She's like, stop correcting me.
It's all good. It's been a day. My English is sucking today. I'm over it.
Nah, you're good. Your accent. I like it.
So, she began her studies at Hazelwood Middle School, but soon after, she transferred to Our Lady of Perpetual Help School, a Catholic school in New Albany, Albany.
Say it however you want.
It was there that she found her passion for basketball and joined the girls' team, embracing the camaraderie and competition that came with the sport. Shanda's journey through different schools and her involvement in various activities shaped her into the vibrant and determined individual she was becoming. But now we're going to
There's always a but.
Yeah. We're going to meet Linda Lovelace, the youngest of 3 daughters. She was born in New Albany on October 28th, 1975 to Marjorie and Larry Lovelace. Larry, who had served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War and achieved the rank of sergeant, returned home emotionally scarred but was hailed a hero. However, Marjorie later revealed that Larry had disturbing tendencies, such as wearing her and her daughter's underwear and makeup.
Ew.
He struggled with monogamy and had a peculiar mix of jealousy and fascination when it came to watching Marjorie engage in sexual activities with other men and women. Throughout Melinda's childhood, they resided in or near New Albany. Following his military service, Larry found irregular employment with the Southern Railroad, which allowed him to work at his convenience. And in 1965, he joined the police department as a probationary officer, but was dismissed after 8 months due to an incident where he and his partner assaulted an African-American male. Larry accused the man of having an affair with his wife, and in 1988, he briefly worked as a mail carrier, but quickly called it quits after just 3 months. During his time as a mail carrier, Larry neglected his duties and brought most of the mail back home to destroy it, showing a lack of commitment to his work.
I wondered what happened with that mail.
Yeah. So Marjorie had been in and out of employment since 1974. When both parents were working, the family enjoyed a comfortable financial situation, residing in the affluent suburbs of Floyd Knobs, Indiana. However, Larry was known for his violent and abusive behavior.
Isn't Larry the guy that liked to wear his wife and daughter's underwear?
Right. And he rarely shared his income with the family and instead spent it on impulsively buying things such as firearms, motorcycles, and cars. And in 1980, he filed bankruptcy. The loveless marriage was often described by extended family members as loveless, for sure, with the daughters frequently visiting their relatives' homes hungry, suggesting they were not receiving adequate food at home. The loveless parents were frequently visiting bars in Louisville, where Larry would deceitfully present himself as a doctor or dentist and introduce Marjorie as his girlfriend. To Marjorie's disgust, he would also involve her in his encounters with friends from work. During one particular traumatic incident, Marjorie actually attempted suicide during an orgy with another couple at their house, a pattern she would sadly repeat multiple times throughout their daughter's childhood. Like, this is...
That is so sick and
this
sad.
This girl, like... When Melinda was just 9 years old, Larry subjected Marjorie to a horrifying gang rape, which led her to attempt to drown herself. So, following those events, Marjorie refused to engage in sexual relations with Larry for a month until he forcibly raped her while their daughters overheard the distressing ordeal through a closed door. In the summer of 1986, after Marjorie prevented Larry from leaving with two women that he met at a bar, he brutally beat her, resulting in her hospitalization. Larry was convicted of battery, and the actual, like, true mistreatment of the daughters still remains uncertain to this day. The testimonies presented in court would later shed the light of the disturbing nature of his actions. According to these testimonies, Larry allegedly engaged in inappropriate touching with Melinda when she was just an infant. Additionally, he was accused of molesting Marjorie's 13-year-old sister during the early stages of their marriage. Another distressing revelation was that Larry allegedly molested the girl's cousin, Teddy, from the ages 10 to 14. While both older girls admitted to being victims of Larry's abuse, Melinda did not acknowledge the experience. It is worth noting that Melinda slept in the same bed as Larry until he abandoned the family when she was 14. So during the court proceedings, Teddy recounted horrifying incidents where Larry allegedly tied up all three sisters in a garage and sexually assaulted them one after the other. However, the sisters did not confirm this specific account. In addition to the sexual abuse, Larry was also verbally abusive towards his daughter. On one occasion, he even fired a gun in the direction of Melinda's older sister, Michelle, when she was just 7 years old, intentionally missing her.
Oh my goodness.
So Larry's disturbing behavior extended to embarrassing his children by publicly finding and smelling their underwear in front of other family members. So this just kind of shows like the kind of environment that she grew up with. And it said at one point during Melinda's early childhood, her family was heavily involved in the Graceland Baptist Church for a period of 2 years. Both her parents, Larry and Marjorie, made a full confession and renounced their previous habits for a while of drinking and swinging while they were active members of the church. Larry even took the role of a Baptist preacher while Marjorie became the school nurse. However, things took a turn when the church arranged for Melinda to undergo a 5-hour exorcism in a motel room supervised by a 50-year-old man.
This just goes to show that not everybody should procreate.
Right. As time went on, Larry's behavior became more increasingly inappropriate, particularly towards women. He gained a reputation of being too forward and even attempting to rape some of them. So this incident led to the Loveless family leaving the church and returning to their previous ways and habits. So in November of 1990, tensions within the family escalated when Larry was caught spying on Melinda and a friend, Marjorie. Marjorie, in a fit of anger, attacked him with a knife, resulting in Larry being hospitalized after attempting to grab it. Marjorie then made another suicide attempt, prompting her daughters to call the authorities. for help. And following these events, Larry filed for divorce and relocated to Avon Park, Florida. And this deeply affected Melinda, especially when she learned that her father had remarried. He initially sent letters to Melinda, manipulating her emotions, but then he eventually cut off all contact with her. And his life came to an end when he was involved in a fatal car crash in St. Louis, Missouri on December 16th, 1998. So, that's our first person that's involved in this, and she's going to be the main...
Melinda?
Melinda is the main person.
Okay.
So we have Mary Lorene Tackett. She went by Lori. That was her nickname. She was born in Madison, Indiana on October 5th, 1974. Growing up, she had a complex family dynamic. Her mother was a devout Pentecostal Christian, while her father had a troubled past with two felony convictions. Unfortunately, Tackett experienced sexual abuse during her childhood, enduring traumatic events from the ages of 5 to 12. And in May 1989, Tackett's mother discovered her changing from a dress into jeans at school, and this led to a heated confrontation that night, resulting in her mother attempting to strangle her. Concerned social workers intervened, ensuring the safety of Tackett by conducting unannounced visits on her home to prevent any other further abuse. So Tackett's relationship with her mother remained strained. And conflict arose periodically. At one point, her mother became alarmed when she learned that Hope Rippey's father had bought a Ouija board for the girls. Fearing the influence of the board, Tackett's mother demanded it be burned and insisted on exorcising the Rippey house. This ain't even her house, and she's trying to exorcise it. Kind of crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
This incident further highlights the tension within the Tackett family and the unique challenges she faced in her upbringing. Following her 15th birthday, Tackett's rebellious nature began to intensify, and she developed a deep fascination for the occult. Seeking attention from her peers, she would often put on a show, pretending to be possessed by a spirit of Deanna the Vampire. As time went on, her behavior took a darker turn, and she began engaging in self-harm, particularly after she started dating a girl involved in such practices in early 1991. Concerned about their daughter's well-being, her parents discovered her self-mutilation and admitted her into the hospital March 19th, 1991. After being prescribed antidepressants, she was released, but just 2 days later, she, along with her girlfriend, Toni Lawrence, cut her wrist deeply, leading to her being readmitted to the hospital. Once again, her wounds were treated. She was transferred to the psychiatric ward for further. It was during this time that Tackett received a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder and revealed that she had been experiencing hallucinations since childhood. She was discharged from the hospital on April 12th and made the decision to drop out of high school in September of 91. And in October of 91, Tackett chose to stay in Louisville and sought refuge with different friends. And it was during this period that she crossed paths with Loveless, and their friendship blossomed. So that's Melinda Loveless. And their friendship blossomed in late November. However, Tackett eventually moved back to Madison in December. And she was enticed by the promise of her father buying her a car. Despite returning to her hometown, she continued to spend the majority of her time in Louisville and New Albany. By December, her bond with Loveless had grown even stronger, and they spent most of their time together, forming a super close and influential relationship with one another. So now, we have our third person, Miss Hope Ann Rippey, which was mentioned earlier. Her dad bought the Ouija board. Was born in Madison, Wisconsin on June 9th, 1976. Her father worked as an engineer at a power plant while her parents went through divorce in February of 1984. Following the separation, Hope and her siblings relocated to Quincy, Michigan, where they lived with their mother for 3 years. The time spent in Michigan was marked by some turbulence in the family. However, in 1987, her parents decided to reconcile and they moved back to Madison. This move allowed Hope to reunite with her childhood friends, Lori Tackett and Toni Lawrence. Despite her parents' concerns about Tackett's influence, It was during her teenage year, at the age of 15, that Rippy began engaging in self-harm and struggle. Self-harm, a struggle she shared with the other girls. So I don't know if Hope and Laurie were the ones that were in a relationship together, but it kind of sounds like it, possibly.
A little bit.
Anyways, so then we have Toni Lawrence. She was born on February 14th, 1976, also Madison, Wisconsin. Her father worked as a boilermaker, and she grew up alongside her close friend, Hope Ann Rippy. Unfortunately, at the age 9, she experienced abuse from a relative, and at 14, she was raped by a teenage boy. Despite reporting the incident, they only issued a restraining order against the boy. So, seeking support, Toni started attending counseling, but eventually discontinued that. The traumatic experience, though, took a toll on her, leading to self-harm, promiscuity, and even a suicide attempt during her 8th grade year. So, 8th grade.
Yeah.
These girls were babies out here showing out like they're grown people. Mm-hmm. But they went through a lot. And that's the reason why I wanted to let you guys see and hear all this before I get into what happens, because this is the worst episode of like a killer kids thing I could have ever done. Mm. So Melinda Lovelace, at 14 year old, started dating another girl named Amanda Heverin in 1990. However, Lovelace's life took a turn when her father left the family and her mother remarried, which we knew that was coming. This significant change seemed to have a negative impact on Lovelace as she began displaying erratic behavior. She got involved in fights at school and expressed feelings of depression, which led her to seek professional counseling. And in March 1991, Lovelace made the brave decision to come out as a lesbian to her mother, following the footsteps of her two older sisters. Initially, her mother was furious, but over time, she came to accept Lovelace's sexual orientation. But unfortunately, as the year went on, Lovelace's relationship with Heverin started to deteriorate. So Amanda Heverin and Shanda Scherer crossed paths during the fall semester at Hazelwood Middle School. Initially, Amanda started a fight with Shanda, but their relationship took a turn when they found themselves in detention together. Surprisingly, they became friends and began exchanging romantic letters at one point. However, Melinda Lovelace, who was already in a relationship with Amanda, started to grow increasingly jealous of this close bond. Things escalated when Amanda took Shanda as her date to a school dance in October of 1991, leading Melinda to confront Shanda. Although Amanda and Melinda didn't officially break up, Melinda had started dating an older girl as well. So the tension continued to rise. Amanda and Shanda attended a festival together again in late October, which only fueled Melinda's anger. She began openly discussing killing Shanda and even threatened her in public. Worried about the negative impact on their daughter, Shanda's parents decided to transfer her to the Catholic school in late November. Amanda claimed to have even given the letters that Melinda sent her containing death threats towards Shanda to a youth prosecutor. However, it seems that the prosecutor didn't take any action based on Amanda's knowledge. So on the fateful night of January 10th, 1992, three teenagers embarked on a chilling journey that would forever change their lives. Toni Lawrence, Hope Rippy, and Laurie Tackett set off in Tackett's car, driving from Madison to Melinda Lovelace's house in New Albany.
Okay, let me stop you real quick.
Uh-huh.
I know what this case is, but I heard it on another podcast, but keep going. Because I was like, this sounds so familiar.
I've never heard of it until...
Well, it just dawned on me when you're mentioning Shanda and Amanda.
Yeah.
Because I remember listening to the episode, I'm like, their names rhyme.
Yeah.
But that was it, so keep going.
Okay. Okay, cool.
I won't say anything.
You're totally fine. So, while Tackett was acquainted with both Rippy and Lawrence, she had never met Lovelace before. And as they arrived, Lovelace lent them some clothes, and in a disturbing twist, she revealed a knife, explaining her intentions to frighten Scherer with it. Tackett was already aware of this sinister plan to murder the 12-year-old girl, Lovelace justified her hatred toward Cher, accusing her of imitating her and stealing her girlfriend. With Rippy now behind the wheel, the four girls made their way to Jeffersonville, where Shanda and Cher resided with her father on the weekends. Along the journey, they stopped at McDonald's restaurant to seek directions. Finally, they reached Cher's house just as darkness began to descend. Lovelace instructed Rippy and Lawrence to approach the door and introduce themselves as friends of Amanda. When Cher answered the door, Rippy and Lawrence inquired about Shanda, to which Cher responded that she was indeed Shanda. Seizing the opportunity, Rippy and Lawrence persuaded her to accompany them to meet Amanda, who was supposedly awaiting them at the Eerie Witch's Castle or Mistletoe Fall. This desolate stone house was perched on a secluded hill overlooking the Ohio River, which would become the haunting backdrop for the tragic events that would unfold over the night. Shanda hesitated to go out and informed her friends that she had a party to attend, and she suggested that girls return around midnight a few hours later. Initially, Melinda was upset, but Rippy and Lawrence reassured her that they would come back for Shanda later that night. The group of four girls then crossed the river to Louisville and attended a punk rock show by the band Sunspring at the Abaddon State Park Skate Park near Interstate 65. However, Lawrence and Rippy quickly lost interest in the music and decided to go to the parking lot outside. There, they engaged in sexual activities with two boys in Tackett's car. Afterwards, the girls eventually left for Cher's house. During the ride, Melinda expressed her eagerness to harm Shanda, but she also mentioned that she only intended to scare her with the knife. When they arrived at Shanda's house at 12:30 a.m., Lawrence refused to go inside and get Shanda, so Tackett accompanied Rippy to the door instead. Meanwhile, Melinda concealed herself under a blanket in the back seat of the car, holding the knife. Shanda's father and stepmother were asleep for the night, giving Shanda permission to stay downstairs and watch TV for a little while longer. However, Rippy informed Shanda that Amanda was still at the witch's castle, which made Shanda hesitant about joining them. Eventually, Shanda agreed to go after changing her clothes. As they all got in the car, Rippy started questioning Shanda about her relationship with Amanda. Unexpectedly, Melinda emerged from the back seat, holding a knife to Shanda's throat, and began interrogating her about her sexual involvement with Amanda. The group then headed towards Utica and the infamous Witch's Castle. Upon arriving at the Witch's Castle, Shanda was brought inside while she sobbed uncontrollably. Her arms and legs were tightly bound with rope, leaving her feeling hopeless and terrified. Melinda took pleasure in taunting Shanda, commenting on her beautiful hair and suggesting how much prettier she would look if it were all cut off. This only intensifies Shanda's fear. Melinda proceeded to remove Shanda's rings and hand them over to the other girls. At one point, Rippy even took Shanda's Mickey Mouse watch and danced to its playful tune. Tackett, not wanting to be left out, further tormented Shanda by claiming that the witch's castle was filled with the remains of their previous victims, insinuating that Shanda would soon join them. To add to the psychological torment, Tackett retrieved a shirt with a smiley design from the car and set it on fire, but quickly grew anxious that the flames would attract attention from passing cars, and which prompted the group to leave with Shanda. Shanda's persistent pleas to be taken back home continued throughout the car ride. As they found themselves lost, they decided to make a stop at a gas station to provide some comfort. They covered Shanda with a blanket while Tackett went inside to seek directions. Now, whether that was actually to provide comfort or to conceal her, we'll never know. Meanwhile, Lawrence took the opportunity to call a boy she knew in Louisville and engage in a conversation for a few minutes, hoping to alleviate her own worries. However, she chose not to disclose the fact that Shanda had been abducted. And once Tackett returned, they resumed their journey but soon found themselves lost again, prompting them to pull over at yet another gas station. It was there that Lawrence and Rippy noticed a couple boys and engaged in conversation with them. After they got back in the car, they continued their journey, eventually arriving to the outskirts of some woods near Tackett's home in Madison. Tackett led the group to an eerie abandoned building nestled deep in within a dense forest. Lawrence and Rippy, overwhelmed by fear, opted to remain in the safety of the car. Meanwhile, Loveless, which is Melinda, and Tackett subjected Shanda to a horrifying ordeal, forcing her to remove her clothing until she was only left in her underwear. Melinda mercilessly pummeled Shanda with her fist, causing immense pain and suffering. Adding to the brutality, Melinda repeatedly slammed Shanda's face against her own knee, resulting in cuts from Shanda's braces. Melinda tried to slash her throat, but the knife proved to be too dull to complete the task. Rippy, unable to bear witness any longer, emerged from the car to restrain Shanda. Loveless and Tackett took turns viciously stabbing Shanda in the chest. Eventually, they resorted to strangling her with a rope until she lost consciousness. With Shanda seemingly lifeless, they callously placed her in the trunk of the car and deceiving the other two girls by claiming that Shanda was dead. Like, they told them that she was dead, but she was not dead. The girls proceeded to drive to Tackett's nearby residence, attempting to clean themselves up from the gruesome events that had just unfolded. Inside the house, they consumed soda and tried to distract themselves from what they had just done. However, that was short-lived when they heard Shanda's agonizing screams coming from the trunk of the car. Tackett, armed with a paring knife, ventured outside and inflicted several more wounds upon Shanda, returning moments later drenched in blood. After cleaning herself up, Tackett delved into the realm of mysticism using rune stones to predict the futures of the other girls. They literally were killing this girl and then acting like nothing was happening. As the night wore on, Lawrence and Rippy chose to remain at Tackett's home while Tackett and Melinda embarked on a gruesome joyride to the nearby town of Canaan. Throughout the journey, Shanda's cries and gurgles persisted, prompting Tackett to halt the car. Opening the trunk, there was Shanda covered in blood, her eyes rolled back and unable to speak. Tackett, driven by a sadistic impulse, savagely beat Cher with a tire iron until she fell silent, claiming to feel the crushing of her skull. It apparently, like, it's reported that Tackett then instructed Loveless to smell the tire iron, I guess to smell the blood on it.
Yeah.
They also sexually assaulted Cher with the same weapon. The tire iron assault continued on and off for hours as the girl continued their joy. So, Melinda and Tackett arrived back at Tackett's house just as the daylight was breaking. Their main objective was to clean up once again, but before they could do so, they woke the other two girls up who were still fast asleep. Rippy inquired about Shanda, and Tackett, with a hint of amusement in her voice, proceeded to vividly describe the horrifying torture that they had inflicted upon her. The conversation unintentionally roused Tackett's mother, like, woke her up, and she initially expressed anger towards her daughter for staying out so late. However, her anger quickly subsided as she offered to prepare breakfast for the girl. She had no idea, like, what had happened. She just heard them talking and laughing, and it woke her up.
Mm-hmm.
So Tackett politely declined the offer, stating she needed to drive the other girls home. Little did they know, Tackett had a different plan in mind. Instead of taking them home, she drove them to the burn pile, where they opened the trunk to catch another glimpse of Shanda's lifeless body. Lawrence, one of the girls, refused to participate in this act. Suddenly, Rippy grabbed a bottle of Windex and sprayed it on Shanda's lifeless body, taunting her with the words, "You're not looking so hot, are you?" The group of girls decided to make a stop at a gas station close to Madison Consolidated High School. They filled up their water, They filled up their car's gasoline and also purchased a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi. However, instead of keeping the Pepsi, Tackett emptied it out and replaced it with gasoline. They continued their journey north of Madison, passing Jefferson Proving Ground until they reached Lemon Road off U.S. Route 421, a location that Rippey was familiar with. While Lawrence stayed in the car, Tackett and Rippey wrapped Shanda, who was still alive at this point, in a blanket and carried her to a field near the Gravel County Road. Rippey proceeded to pour gasoline on Shanda, and then they cruelly set her on fire. Melinda, however, wasn't entirely convinced that Shanda was dead, so they returned a few minutes later to pour the remaining gasoline on her. After this horrifying incident, the girls decided to go to McDonald's at 9:30 to have breakfast. It was during this meal that they callously laughed about Shanda's badly burned body, compared it to one of the sausages that they were eating. Following their meal, Lawrence made a phone call to a friend and shared the detail of the murder. Tackett then dropped off Lawrence and Rippey at their homes before returning to her own residence with Melinda. Melinda confided in Amanda and informed her about the gruesome act that they had committed and was making arrangements to pick Amanda up later that day with Tackett. Melinda's friend Crystal Walton paid a visit to Melinda's house, and they wasted no time in sharing the shocking news with her as to what had happened. Eager to ensure that their friend Amanda was aware of the events, the trio hopped in the car and drove over to pick her up. Once they arrived at the residence, they recounted the tale to Amanda. Initially, both Amanda and Walton found it difficult to believe the story until Tackett presented them with the undeniable evidence, the trunk of the car, still bearing Shanda's bloodied handprints and socks. The sight left Amanda utterly horrified, prompting her to request to be taken home immediately. As they pulled up in front of Amanda's house, Melinda, overwhelmed with emotion, kissed Amanda, professing her love for her and desperately pleading with her to keep the incident a secret. In a moment of vulnerability, Amanda assured Melinda she would not disclose the events before entering her house. On the morning of January 11, 1992, two brothers from Canaan were driving towards Jefferson Proving Ground for a hunting trip when they made the shocking discovery. As they were driving, they spotted what they initially thought was a mannequin on the side of the road. However, upon closer inspection, they realized that it was the charred body of a child. Immediately recognizing the severity of the situation, they contacted the police at 10:55 a.m. and were instructed to stay at the scene. State Trooper David Kim with Jefferson County Sheriff Buck Shipley and a team of detectives arrived to begin their investigation. Initially, they suspected the crime to be related to a drug deal gone wrong, but the disturbing nature of the crime became more apparent when they discovered the victim's body had been deliberately posed in a suggestive manner. Her face and hands had been intentionally burned to prevent easy identification, and she was found with her arms outstretched and fist clenched, a result of the fatal burn she had suffered. Meanwhile, Shanda's father, Stephen, was growing increasingly concerned when he realized that his daughter was missing. After contacting neighbors and friends without any success, he reached out to Shanda's mother at 1:45. Together, they promptly filed a missing persons report to the Clark County Sheriff's Office, hoping for any leads to locate their daughter. Lawrence and Shippey rushed to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office along with their parents at 8:20 p.m. They provided lengthy, incoherent statements referring to the victim as Shanda and attempted to identify the other two girls involved to the best of their abilities. They also recounted the main events of the previous night. Following an extensive investigation spanning multiple counties, Shippey, a detective, reached out to the Clark County Sheriff's Office and successfully matched the body to Shanda's missing persons report. So, in order to confirm the victim's identity, detectives obtained dental records, which established that Shanda was indeed the victim. This crucial piece of evidence further solidified the case, and on January 12th, Melinda and Tackett were apprehended and taken into custody. The arrest warrant was primarily supported on the statements provided by Lawrence and Rippey, which formed the bulk of the evidence that they had. Prosecution wasted no time in announcing their intention to try both Loveless and Tackett as adults. For several months, the details of the case remained undisclosed by both the prosecution and defense attorneys, leaving the news media with only the statements given by Lawrence and Rippey. So they didn't go into detail of what all really happened.
Insane.
So the courts decided to treat all four girls as adults, resulting in charges being filed against them as well. In order to avoid facing the death penalty, the girls made the decision to accept plea bargains. It is important to consider the mitigating factors surrounding these girls' lives. Some of them did have difficult home environments where they experienced physical or sexual abuse at the hands of parents or another adult. Additionally, Lawrence, Rippey, and Tackett had a history of self-harm, indicating the emotional struggles that they faced. Tackett, one of the girls involved, was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and was also dealing with hallucinations, which further complicated her mental state. Melinda, who was often seen as the leader in the attack, had the most extensive history of abuse, mental health issues, and among the group. These factors all shed light and helped with those plea bargains when they were doing that. They took all of that into account. That's the reason why I wanted to read that to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys could kind of see where they came from and why.
Right.
So Tackett and Loveless found themselves facing a 60-year sentence at the Indiana Women's Prison in Indianapolis. However, their paths diverged as Tackett was granted release in 2018 and served a year of probation.
So she's out there walking around?
Yes. Melinda Loveless, on the other hand, had to wait until September 2019 to regain her freedom.
So she's out.
Yeah. Rippey, too, faced a 60-year sentence, but with some leniency due to mitigating circumstances, 10 years were suspended. Additionally, she was placed under 10 years of medium supervision probation. However, on appeal, a judge reduced her sentence to 35 years. Lawrence, in a different turn of events, managed to secure a plea deal by cooperating with authorities. As a result, she pled guilty to one count of criminal confinement and received a maximum sentence of 20 years.
That's insane.
Yeah.
So they're out?
Some of them are. Yeah. Actually, I think they're all out now. Loveless's attorney, Mark Small, made a request in October of 07 for a hearing to argue his client's release. He claimed that Melinda had suffered severe mental impairment due to childhood abuse. Additionally, Small argued that Loveless had not received competent legal representation during her sentencing, leading her to accept a plea bargain based on exaggerated claims about the possibility of facing the death penalty. Small further contended that Melinda, who was only 16 years old at the time of signing the plea bargain, was too young to enter into a contract without a parental or guardian consent, which had not been obtained. If the judge accepted these arguments, Loveless could have been retried or released outright. However, on January 8th, 2008, Jefferson Circuit Court Judge Ted Todd rejected her request. Said it was determined that she would be eligible for parole after serving 15 years, thus upholding the original plea deal. This decision was upheld by the Indiana State Court of Appeals on November 14th of 2008, and they denied her appeal as well. Mark Small expressed his intentions to seek jurisdiction over the case to be transferred to the Indiana Supreme Court. And then Lawrence was released on December 14th, 2000, after serving 9 years. She remained on parole until December of 2002. And on April 28th, 2006, Rippey was released from Indiana Women's Prison on parole after serving 14 years of her original sentence. She remained supervised parole for 5 years. As I said, Tackett was released from Rockville Correctional Facility January 11th, 2018, which was the 26th anniversary of Cher's death, after serving nearly 26 years. Melinda Loveless was released from Indiana Prison on September 5th, 2019, after serving 26 plus years in prison, and she will she still serves on, she's still on parole in Jefferson County. So Melinda's sentencing hearing did shed light on the extent of abuse inflicted by her father, Larry. The court testimony revealed a disturbing pattern of abuse that took place between 1968 and 77. And in February of 1993, Larry was arrested on charges of rape, sodomy, and sexual battery. Her father was arrested for what he'd done. He awaited trial in prison for over 2 years, but due to the statute of limitations, most of the charges were dropped. Eventually, he pled guilty to one count sexual battery and received a sentence of time served, and he was released in June of 1995. After being released from prison, he filed a lawsuit against the Floyd County Jail seeking $39 million in federal court. He claimed that he had endured cruel and unusual punishment during his two-year incarceration. Among his grievances were the alleged denial of sleeping in his bed during the day and being deprived of reading the newspaper. His lawsuit was unsuccessful.
What a guy.
Yeah. Stephen Scherer, the father of Shanda, tragically passed away in 2005 at the age of 53 due to alcoholism. In a heartfelt interview with Shanda's mother, Jackie Vault, on the investigative Discovery series Deadly Women, Vault revealed the immense pain her husband experienced after their daughter's murder.
I mean, that goes without saying.
Yeah. She shared that he was so devastated that he resorted to the destructive behaviors, going to great lengths to harm himself emotionally. Vault expressed that he essentially drank himself to death as his heart was shattered at the loss of their beloved daughter. In January 2009, the Shanda Scherer Scholarship Fund was established with the noble intention of providing educational opportunities to deserving students. Specifically, the fund aimed to grant scholarships to two students annually from Prosser School of Technology in New Albany. One scholarship was designated for a student pursuing further education, while the other was intended for a student embarking on their career journey and in need of financial support to purchase the tools or work equipment. However, as of November 2018, her mother shared the sad news that the scholarship fund had been completely depleted. Due to this depletion, the fund is no longer able to accept any further donations, despite the initial hope and generosity behind the establishment of the funds. In 2012, though, Jackie Vault reconnected with Melinda Lovelace.
Ew.
Wait for it. Albeit indirectly. Marking her first contact since the trials, Vault decided to donate a dog named Angel to Melinda Lovelace, who would then train the canine for the Indiana Canine Assistance Network program through Project to Heal. This program aims to provide service pets to individuals with disabilities, making a positive impact on their lives. Despite facing criticism for her decision, Vault firmly defended it, emphasizing that it was her personal choice. She expressed that she's Shanda, my child. If we don't allow good things to emerge from bad situations, nothing will improve. And I know that my child would have wanted this. And Vault's ultimate goal was to donate a dog every year to tribute to Shanda Scherer, honoring her memory and spreading positivity. So her mom, while Melinda was in prison, sent a dog. And each year she was sending a dog for Melinda to train to go to somebody who needed it. Wow. For somebody with disabilities. Like, come on now. That's one of the toughest cases I've ever read. That was those girls.
Like, yeah. I ended up finding out that I had already listened to this on a podcast that I listened to, but doesn't take away from the severity or the importance of, you know, talking about this case. But
because not only did it hurt them, not only did they hurt that girl and themselves, but her dad drank himself to death.
Mm-hmm. That's insane. So,
wow. Anyways, that's the story of the murder of Shanda Scherer.
That was intense.
It was intense. It was rough.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of commentary because I've already heard it, but if y'all have things to say about it, please comment on our Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, wherever we post pictures and information. Thank you for that, though.
Like, I mean, I don't feel like I need to be thanked. It was rough.
No, I mean, thank you for taking that on and bringing light to it, because it's a big deal. Whether it happened last week or 50 years ago, it doesn't matter.
Kids can be so cruel.
And it was a crime of, like, middle school passion.
Right.
Disgusting.
And
disgusting that that is the length that it had to go to. And I get that the women were...
Puppy love. I mean, that's really all it was.
But no, seriously, like...
At the age of 12, 13, 14, you don't know what love is. You shouldn't be doing any of the things they were doing.
No, that's insane. But if y'all have commentary, please let us know. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Patreon. And yeah, that was it. We don't know where we're going next, but no, wherever it is, it's going to be interesting.
It's going to be your decision, so let us know.
Yeah.
We'll have that put up before long.
Yeah. So, any parting words for the fans?
Lock your doors. Don't be bullies.
Yeah, and as always, there's probably something sinister right in your own backyard.